We, the members of the secret order of alchemical actors, do solemnly commit ourselves to a full and honest telling of the history of the occult as far as we know it.
All right. My name is Dr. Rob C. Thompson, here with another interview special for you. Very special, very excited about this today. Another intersection of paranormal culture, vampire culture, and tourism, one of my favorite topics. Luke Kinneman, our producer of Discordia, is here with me. Luke?
Hello.
Hello. How are things?
Things have been and things are happening.
They are happening. Luke is not only the producer of our interview episodes, but also moderates our Discord channel. And we do encourage you. We've had folks flocking to Discord of late. I do want to mention that Facebook, our Facebook group, God love Zuckerberg, but it's just sort of a disaster over there. So I'm encouraging folks, if you're on our Facebook group, to go ahead and make the switch to Discord, where Luke is minding the store. All right, Luke, who do we have here with us today?
Well, joining us today, we have Ed Krimi, the director and chief curator of the Vampa Museum in Doylestown, Pennsylvania. Ed, hello.
How you doing today?
Wonderful. How are you?
Doing well, doing well. I heard your pledge.
Ah, yes. And any thoughts?
Well, I just didn't understand one part. If it's a secret society, and it's not a secret anymore, because you told everyone that you're a secret society.
Well, you can't tell anyone that we're a secret.
Wait, you're telling people that you're a secret society, but then you're on a podcast. So how is it a secret?
No, no, no. We're just telling you. It's okay.
Oh, okay. I'm the only one that knows this. This is not going to be on air that you're a secret society.
No, we didn't warn you, Ed, that this actually is a very small audience.
Okay. You only have two guys, and they both know that you're a secret society.
Yeah, those two guys are also in the recording. It's a very, very small group.
Okay, yes, now indeed. I understand. I'm glad we got that straight.
All right, so we want to kind of dig in. You know, your museum was recommended to us by, again, got a lovely plug for our Discord community. One of our community listeners recommended that we kind of look into and made me want to reach out. So before I kind of get into some questions, Ed, you and I were talking before we actually started recording. Tell me a little bit about yourself, because you have such a beautiful foundation that you're building this from.
Thank you. Well, I'm in the antique business. That's my primal business. Been doing it for over 45 years. And I've been collecting paranormal objects during that time frame. Lucky for me that because of my business and other activities, I've traveled around the world. And this is how I acquired a lot of these items.
Now, with acquiring these items, what drew you to them? Like, what's your attachment to the occult?
Well, I've always been attached to the more concept of God and Jesus. So it really stems from having a Roman Catholic background. I'm from Brooklyn. I'm Italian. So that's where our family's culture is from. My grandfather's brother was a priest, and he would do exorcisms. So the family has a lot of stories regarding that. And it's been something of interest throughout my years and throughout my father's years as well, and the entire family.
Ed, do you think that Roman Catholicism also makes you more interested in, like, the artifact? I think about the relics of the Catholic Church.
It does. I mean, I do love the aesthetics of these items. And we call our one room with all the vampire killings, as we call it, the Art of the Kill. That is the exhibition. So these items are very precious in themselves. They are hand-carved in walnut, semi-precious stones, ivory. They're beautiful objects in itself.
And how do you find them? I mean, you're traveling the world. Are you in antique stores, or how do you come across these?
Well, I do travel around the world, primarily from the age of 20 to, I would say, pre-COVID, I've spent 2 to 3 months a year overseas in Europe, in Thailand, Indonesia, China. I used to be a professional kickboxer in Thailand, so I had the opportunity while I was traveling the circuit as a kickboxer in my 20s and being in the antique business to have the ability to find these rare objects. You would find them in churches. You would find them in private collections. People would sometimes give them to me, especially if they felt there was a paranormal attachment to them.
But tell me about that. So somebody wants to relieve themselves of,
yes,
of the object?
Absolutely. There are people that inherit items and they're not comfortable with the energy from those items. So they would call me up and said, Ed, you know, we would like to get rid of this item. Will you take it for your museum? Is this is something that we can donate to the museum? So we've been very fortunate to receive items like that as well.
Give us some examples.
Well, recently, actually, it was just last week, we had a person call us up that was an antique dealer that purchased a collection in Bucks County. He had an item. It was actually a doll that was in a high chair, all hand-carved from the 19th century. The doll had iron spikes in it, skeleton heads all around it, and it's really quite creepy. It actually belonged to the person that started the Farmer's Almanac. That was the provenance on the item. So he hired me to get the item and to donate it. He wanted to donate it to the museum, and we're still considering that. We do have the item. We place all the items when we receive an item into another facility on the property, and we let it sit there, and I usually bless it, holy water, salt, and try to just make sure that's something that I'm comfortable putting in this museum.
So there's things you're not comfortable adding to the collection?
Eventually, we probably can add everything if we have the space, but there are items that have been in the storage facility for 20 years at this point. Not ready yet.
Tell me about this. So does the energy dissipate? I mean, how does this work with the time passage?
Well, you know, as much as I've been involved in this, no one is an expert in celestial beings. No one's an expert in demons. Our finite mind cannot conceive things of that nature. So it's really a matter of just what we feel and what we believe. I usually go by a feeling. It's something that I try to ascertain whether the item is still have some energy, and especially it could have positive energy as well. Not all items that have a influence to them are demonic. Some of them are just beautiful.
And is it always an angel demon sort of energy, or is there, I mean, as a Roman Catholic, are you comfortable with hauntings, ghostly presences?
I am comfortable with hauntings and ghostly presences. Like I said, I do identify as a Roman Catholic. I am studying to be a deacon. However, I'm also an ordained minister at this point with the Universal Life Church. So I do believe in ghosts as well.
And you have artifacts that reflect both,
yes,
I guess,
yes,
ways of thinking.
Yes.
So tell us a bit about the history of the museum, how it came together. You're in Doylestown, PA? Did you say that, Luke?
We're in Doylestown, Pennsylvania. That's where we are. We originally were in Lambertville, New Jersey, which is about 10 minutes, 15 minutes away. We had a small space, but we couldn't keep up. There were so many people wanting to see the museum. It was in an antique center called the People's Store, and we were blocking a lot of the stairwells by the people waiting. So I decided to pack up that museum and bring it to my property in Doylestown. It's on 6 acres, the property.
Oh, wow.
We have a dinosaur park for children. We have a maze here. My antique business is here. My karate dojo is here. And I have a large Victorian house. My children are all grown adults now, so I didn't need such a house at this point. So I turned it into the museum.
Very cool. I grew up in Trenton, New Jersey. So when I'm up visiting mom, I'm going to have to get over and check out this, all this stuff. My kid loves dinosaurs too. This is perfect.
Hey, I'll bring mine too. We can visit my brother while we're up there.
Yeah.
Oh, that'd be great. We have a lot of people coming to the property, and we also donate money to the St. Jude's Hospital as well. So a lot of times people give donations when they walk into the dinosaur park, and the money goes to a good cause.
Oh, that's awesome.
So you already had the Doylestown property as when you were operating in Lambertville?
Yes, yeah, Doylestown property I hadn't when I was in Lambertville. I have Doylestown property for about 30 years now.
Okay, all right. Cool. And how do you advertise this? Do you have to advertise? Are people just drawn to you?
Well, the amazing part, we did get a lot of good publicity in the beginning from newspapers, but it's really all about TikTok. TikTok brings us most of our customers at this point. We're not advertising a lot, especially now that we're in the winter, because we didn't think we'd get so many people. But TikTok is bringing in so many people. We're doing numbers now that I was anticipating to do in October of 2024. We're already at those numbers.
Wow. So what are you're posting like your artifacts on TikTok for people to check out?
No, the people that walk through the museum, they're the ones that do it. We're not really doing much with that infrastructure. We're really just working with the people that are coming to the museum and posting on TikTok.
That's wild. So people are doing it for you.
Yep. Yep.
That's kind of fantastic, though. It takes all the advertising off your plate.
We're going to do more advertising in the spring, though. That's when I think we're really going to hit it strong. You know, I'm not a technical person. I'm lucky that I have good people in the tech department. I'm more of the person acquiring the item and working also my day job selling antiques. But we plan to do more. And a lot of interesting things we plan to do in the spring. I was recently, in May, I was at the Exorcism Conference in Rome. I was invited as a layperson at that time. And I saw some incredible films of exorcisms. Really beautiful. Not like you see in the movies with scary nights and people, you know, with scary music. But this was like more of a form of liberation. So I really had an amazing opportunity to have that come into my life.
Wow, that's you are really a traveler, Ed. That's amazing.
Yes, been around the world a lot.
And a kickboxer. So, and tell me about Asia then a little bit. I mean, let's go back to that real quick. So what are some differences in the paranormal culture of Thailand and, let's say, Italy?
Okay, big differences. But, you know, every country, even within the country, have differences. So the European concept is a lot different than the Asian concept, but there's still a lot of crossover. I mean, the Asian concept of the jinn and ghost do have familiarity to the European. Now, I like to point out that I'm not, even in the museum, I don't have anything really to do with Dracula, because that's fiction. I'm more into vampires, which I really consider demons, as opposed to the concept of the fictional character Dracula from Bram Stoker.
Which I think is understandable, because you're right. Bram Stoker created this character to essentially create a piece of fiction. I mean, everything, even reading back through like Stoker's Dracula now, like a couple years ago when I tried to read it, this is going to sound like a little bit bad. But
when you tried, Luke, did you try and fail?
I know.
Well, yeah, I failed, because it's just, it's structured in such a way, like the letters back and forth and then the chunks of newspaper. It's just, I have no connection to it. I've got no connection to Dracula either. I just think, you know,
so Luke gives the epistolary novel one thumb down.
Yes.
Well, you know, for me, I love the movie Blade. I think that's really cool. So I do like a lot of the vampire movies. And actually, there used to be a show called The Night Stalker when I was young. And the first episode was about a vampire. And I think that also gave a lot of interest to me.
So where does your love of vampires come from then? So let's build on that a bit.
I don't love vampires.
Okay, fascination with vampires. Sorry.
Interest, yeah.
My fascination comes from the concept how art has been influenced by the battle between good and evil over the centuries. So my fascination comes from an art background as well as a concept of seeing how the supernatural and how the philosophy of theology correspond together and sometimes correspond very differently to each other.
But thinking about, you know, like vampiric culture and your understanding of it, your knowledge of it, is there any, let me rephrase this, in your kind of studies and understanding, do you have any sort of historical point where you like to step everything off from, or where do you think this boom of like the vampire mythos came from, or really when did it come into existence? When did it enter into prominence?
Well, the myth of the vampire is basically from folklore. A lot of times people could not explain the unexplainable. We also have to realize that hundreds of years ago, only about 25% of the population actually were able to read and write. So folklore was developed through oral tradition. People will tell stories, and people will tell stories from another village. It's not like today, like you would have a telephone or YouTube that you can see something instantly. It sometimes would take time. It would get basically a whisper down the lane type of concept. So people were in fear. So in order to deal with the fears, they had to come up with some type of myth. Now, for centuries, there's always been people that were bad. There's always people that were killing other people. And in order to deal with this understanding of what happened, people will follow the myth of the vampire or demon. With, you know, it's very similar. It parallels a lot of time.
Okay, so let me pose what might be a bit of a controversial question to you if we're thinking of vampires in the context of demons. But say you're back in, you know, late 1600s and something terrible happens. You know, someone is killed. We find their mutilated corpse. Do you think that, you know, the tale of the vampire, this mythos, could be something that you could use to soften the blow or a way to help people experience or not have to look at the cruelty of humanity and the cruelty of man itself?
I'm sure that's the case. I'm sure that a lot of times people have used that myth incorrectly in order to satisfy wanting an explanation. I'm sure there were mass murderers in the 16th century. I think that every person was really trying to just deal with something that was difficult to deal with. I mean, there are times when people have mental illness as well, and they would say, well, that person is demonic. That person is a vampire. There is a combination of both. You can have a mental illness and have a demonic influence as well, or a vampiric influence. So I do think that you're correct in that.
So when we think about you, going back to your artifacts, Ed, I mean, you talk about the artifacts having a negative energy. Do you think that that plays a role in some of this vampire phenomena? Is there a negative energy that exists out there independent of us, or do we create that negative energy that lingers?
I think it's a combination of both. I think a lot of the vampire killing devices don't necessarily have a negative energy. Remember, I do have voodoo boxes. I do have occult items as well, but now we're talking specifically about the vampire items. The vampire items, a lot of time it's the edification of good. You would have a crucifix in it. You would have holy water, a Bible to build up the edification of the vampire hunter. You would have salt. See, a lot of times, even in the early 17th century, besides salt being a purification, they believe that if you place salt on the floor in front of a demon/vampire, he would have to count every morsel of the salt because he had a form of OCD. And that's where we get into Sesame Place, Count Dracula. That's where that concept comes from. Everyone thinks it's the other Count Dracula, but it's because he can count and have to count.
Count his morsels of salt.
But he counts fast vampires, so you don't have a lot of time. People think they put the salt on the floor and all of a sudden they have minutes, they have seconds. They're very fast counters.
So who's putting together these kits? Is it vampire hunters? Is it regular people who are just worried? I mean, who's doing this?
A combination. There would be usually companies during that time that would make the kits, especially it got commercial when people were traveling to Transylvania. There would be individuals that would also make the kits. A lot of the elaborate carvings that you see would be discarded furniture pieces. Like there's a company called Dufont in Paris, and they made amazing furniture. And a lot of time pieces didn't really meet their specifications. So people would take the carvings of the legs and carve weapons out of it. I tell people all the time that vampire killing sets do not come from seeds. They have to be made by somebody.
And you would carry that with you wherever you go?
They would, yeah. I mean, the smaller kits they would carry, especially in travel. The larger kits would sometimes be in a restaurant, in a pub, because people would feel secure if that business had something to protect them from vampires as they were traveling.
So it's like the shotgun behind the bar.
Exactly. It's the shotgun behind the bar.
Well, let's dig into these kits a little bit, because you had mentioned you might find the crucifix, Bible, salt, a stake. So within the smaller kit, I'm assuming you can kind of quickly carry it on your person. What kind of loadout is in that compared to one of these larger kits you might see in a more public area?
Basically the same, just the larger kits will have more items in it. But even a small kit would have a Bible, crucifix, daggers. A lot of times you will find weapons like guns with silver bullets as well.
Are there elements of like the popular folklore that weren't believed at the time period? I mean, would there be garlic in there?
Oh, absolutely. Garlic would be in a lot of the kits. Yes, yes.
So our lore today that, you know, gets into Buffy and all is pretty standard.
I would think so. I've never seen Buffy the Vampire Killer. No. I don't know, but I would think so.
I mean, the Dracula lore, right? I mean, it sort of holds up.
Yes, yes. And that's where Bram Stoker got a lot of its concepts from early writings from the 1700s and the 1600s as well.
And where do your kits come from? Do they come from all over Europe, or are they mostly manufactured in Western Europe so that you could go to Eastern Europe?
You know, I have kits from Italy, Germany, a lot in Germany, France, England did a lot. America did a lot as well, especially during the 19th century.
So Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter, real thing.
Yeah, yeah. And great movie, too. Another good movie.
So thinking about these kits then and kind of exploring some of the other artifacts you've collected, what process do you have when it comes to selecting your artifacts or really committing to one, putting it into display, putting another one aside? Or are there times when you're meeting with someone discussing the collection itself or the artifact that tells you it's not necessarily worth it? Or what is it that does draw you to the items that you have attained or that you have collected?
Well, they're very rare to find, so I try to buy everyone I can get my hands on.
Fair.
I usually go with aesthetics. I like the beautiful carvings. If there's an interesting provenance with it, I have a lot of kits. David Guest, who was Liza Minnella's husband, was a client of mine many, many years ago, and I acquired his collection. I have items from Jack Palance's when he passed away. So if they have a nice provenance to it, I do like it. Most of the kits are very beautiful. Sometimes there are kits that are a little more simple, but most of them have a lot of elegant artwork involved with it.
David Guest collected vampire kits.
Yes.
That's wild.
He had a lot too. He had a big collection. We purchased a huge amount from him when he was alive.
Do you know where your collection rates? Like, do you have one of the larger collections in the world of vampire kits?
Well, the Guinness Book of World Record, I think, states that Ripley's, believe it or not, has, I think, 11 or 13 pieces. I have over 1,000.
So you guys could put that on the postcard if you wanted to.
Yeah, we could definitely put that on the postcard.
There's holy water in there too. We mentioned holy water. I thought that was interesting. I read on your website people would put it, you said, in different containers, like whatever they had on hand.
Yes, they would have a lot of holy water. They would put it in different bottles to also keep the vampires away, a way of fighting the vampires or demons. Remember, you know, when I talk about vampires, I do vampire/demons because I'm a firm believer in the demonic with this.
So is an exorcism kit different from a vampire kit?
Good question. So in a vampire kit, the goal is to kill the host, the person. In an exorcism kit, the goal is to liberate the soul. So there's a big difference.
Tell us more.
Okay. Well, basically, when you're performing an exorcism, you don't want to kill the person. You want to liberate the person. You want the demonic entity to leave that person. When it comes to vampire kits, it would be to kill that /vampire/person. So a lot of times, I think, unfortunately, people were considered to be vampires, but they were not vampires. They were just bad people. So there is a big difference between exorcisms and vampire killing sets.
And if you had an exorcism, you pretty much just need the Bible then. You
Bible,
don't want a weapon.
Holy water. I mean, you would always have a crucifix. Those would be primarily the things you would need for an exorcism. And a very strong edification of strength and will and a very strong belief in God. And Mother Mary is the most powerful of all the people, celestial beings, that the devil is afraid of, even more than Archangel Michael.
So you might have rosary beads.
You would have rosary beads as well.
Interesting. So do you have those sort of artifacts as well?
I do have exorcism kits as well.
How far back do they go in your collection, age-wise?
Probably in the neighborhood of the 1600s.
Wow. How have these things changed? I mean, a vampire kit sounds very specific. Do they change over time?
Not really. I mean, you would have different woods that different cultures. But basically, you know, the only big difference you would have, sometimes there would be like pepper box guns in them and silver bullets. A lot of them don't have it, but they haven't really changed that much.
So as weaponry changes, that
evolve. A lot of weaponry changes, and some are very primitive looking as well, and some are very intense looking. I mean, spears and spikes and ways to decapitate the head of the vampire.
And I'm assuming on the inverse of that, an exorcist kit has probably been fairly consistent. I can't imagine there'd be any real need for a change.
The only changes in exorcism is basically various canons that have changed over the centuries with the Catholic Church. Different mythology to perform the exorcisms. And also you would have it in different religions. You know, you would have the Roman Catholic Church, you would have Protestant ministers, you would have the Greek Orthodox. You know, they all had very similar ways and some slight differences. And that's what I learned at the exorcism conference, that there's an underlying thread going through all those religions. And the differences are so minute sometimes that who the heck cares?
So it's, it'll get the job done.
It'll get the job done. Exactly. It'll get the job done.
What other artifacts accrue around vampire culture and paranormal culture for you?
Well, we also have the items that were there to kill the familiars, the people that actually protected the vampire. So there was a lot of various weapons on that basis as well.
Oh, go into that now. Tell us more about familiars.
Okay, well, the familiars, and that's a word, believe it or not, that's a word that they used in a lot of movies. And it's actually a word that was used in the 16th and 17th century as well. Basically, there are people that believed in the vampire folklore and were hoping for immortality. And they would then help these people that they believed were vampires / demons or / just mentally people with mental illnesses, and they would do whatever it takes to help the vampire.
So they were just, you were like a regular person.
They were like a regular person hanging out with a demonic entity, and they would want to protect that demonic entity. So weapons were made also to fight the familiars as well, especially in a lot of towns where you might have a group of 20 familiars protecting, let's just call it an evil person, and there would be an all-out gang war at that point.
Oh, wow. 20 of them. Man, that's insane.
And their only belief is that this person, this bad person, is just going to somehow grant them an extended life or immortality or protection, anything to kind of keep them going.
Exactly. Yeah, that was usually it.
So there's artifacts around combating them. Exactly. As opposed to the vampire.
And they're
so
more intense weapons. They're actually sometimes, they're usually larger weapons. So almost like a spear oriented, you would definitely find some axe. You would have also things that look like European gauntlets with spikes coming out of it. So just very interesting battle weapons. Very similar to a lot of the weapons even used in armament that you would see in the 1600s by knights.
Are they, are the familiars, do they have some kind of supernatural ability the way we think about the vampire?
I don't believe so. I don't believe the familiars had a supernatural ability. I also don't believe a lot of vampires had a supernatural ability.
Right. But did the person holding that gauntlet think that that's what they were doing?
Well, yeah, that is the testimony of the belief. And all these vampire killing sets are the testimony of the seriousness of people believing in vampires.
Mm-hmm.
So between the two, it almost seems like the vampire killing set has a bit more elegance to it. Do you think there's root behind that?
Yes. They're just beautiful. I think that if people were selling them, they wanted to sell something that just looked beautiful. Back then people took pride in wood carvings. They took pride in using lapis and ivory and malachite and semi-precious stones. So it was more of what the culture was about. I mean, we have so many beautiful artwork during the Renaissance period. So people just like to make beautiful stuff.
So tell us a little bit about people who visit the museum. What kind of experience do you have with them? Who comes to the museum and what questions do they have for you?
That's a good question. So it's a mixture of different people. One of the rooms that we have in the museum, which is my favorite room, is the room dedicated to the Archangel Michael. We have a room at the end. We have probably approximately 30 paintings and sculpture and marble and wood carvings. And this is all to show the power of good over evil. Like I said before, that is the primal directive of what, the way I want the museum to go. People come in at a fascination a lot of times for the supernatural, but we try to bring them closer to the concept of God and in my belief in Jesus and Mother Mary. So they come in, they look at the vampire killing sets. They're fascinating. I mean, it's beautiful artwork. But then as they go to the museum, and a lot of times there's some areas that are, you know, a little frightful, especially the area which we have a Ouija board, which we try to have people not take photographs of. And we have a doll room, which is also pretty intense. Then they go into the last room, which shows, like I said, the edification of Archangel Michael and good over evil. And it's a calming spirit. People seem to leave there feeling good. And we have all types of people. We have couples coming in. We have older people. We have religious people. We have goth people. We have a really diverse group of people. And I find, which is actually interesting, because I try to spend time on the weekends to talk with people. I find that such a large, almost 99.9% of all the people, they're interested in the spirit. They're interested in good. They're interested in kindness. They're interested in being helpful to children. There is not really a dark energy that comes into the museum. It's just a fascination. And I love that. And that's why I have the museum, and that's why we have the park in the front, because I want the museum ultimately to be a place where people feel good, which brings them closer to whatever religion that they're comfortable with, and just to understand good. Because to me, good and evil, it's pretty simple. It's not that complicated for me. Just be good.
Just be good.
Just be good, exactly.
I'm going to ask a couple questions, Luke, then I'll let it go back to you. I just want to walk through these rooms with you now, Ed.
That's exactly what I wanted to do.
Yeah. So let's start with the Ouija boards. A lot of beliefs around Ouija boards. You don't want folks photographing them. Tell me why.
Well, a lot of times people who have photographed the Ouija boards have had their cameras, phone cameras break. So There's been some energy there. I personally, when my children were in my home, I didn't have a large collection of vampire killing sets, but they would see them around the house. I would never have a Ouija board. And I believe that Ouija boards are a portal to darkness, but I also believe that it's what is in your mind that creates that darkness. I mean, I don't give any power to any of the items. I live upstairs above the museum. And I'm not afraid, because I know that my belief in good is much stronger than evil. So the Ouija boards are one of the items that creep a lot of people out. And also people are fascinated. I mean, today I had a group of people taking pictures of the Ouija board. I was like, stop, don't do that. And they're like, why? I said, because it's not a good idea. Go in the room and take a picture of the Archangel Michael. It's better.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's interesting. I worked with spiritualist mediums for a long time. I did my research with them, and they talked about it as sort of like an open door. And they said, you don't know who's going to get through the door. But for your perspective, Ed, correct me if I'm wrong here, that your mindset when you're playing with the Ouija board is already a little spooky. You want to be spooked. And so you're inviting a darker presence into your life.
Absolutely. And a lot of it, you know, I've studied psychology and neuroscience as well. So to me, it's all three. It's spirituality, neuroscience, and psychology. You walk into the room, a bunch of young kids, and they see the Ouija board, and they create this fiction in their mind. I don't believe it's necessarily always a reality. I do believe in demons, but a lot of times it's just imagination.
And that can sometimes take on a separate presence from yourself.
Exactly. And today we had an interesting experience because someone heard in our doll rooms some voices, and they're actually going to put that on TikTok. And the woman actually took a video of it, and I did hear it. And that's not the first time that I've heard that people have heard voices in the doll room. So I found that a little fascinating.
All right, let's do that doll room, Ed. What is going on in the doll room?
You know, we have one doll from the early 19th century that is from Burma. And this one particular doll, I feel has an energy force to it, let's say. And other people have felt the same way.
How does this happen with dolls? I mean, this is common, right? Ed and Lorraine Warren, right, famously right. Had Annabelle. Like, there's these dolls that collect that. Why?
Why the dolls?
Yeah.
I think that a lot of times the doll imagery is very powerful. And demonic influence likes to go into imagery. So if you have a piece of wood, okay, it's just a plain piece of wood. But if you have a doll, I feel that the demons are more inclined to go into an imagery of a person. Remember, demons hate people.
So it has a kind of iconic power to it.
It brings it in, yes. I believe the dolls can bring in a demonic energy.
You know, my daughter hates dolls. My godmother gave her a doll for Christmas, and all she took that she looked at it and she said, "I hate dolls." And there's my mother actually in her bedroom. She has an angel sitting next to her nightstand, and my daughter will sometimes sleep in grandma's bedroom, but she won't sleep. The angel has to go away. She doesn't like the face, even the angelic face. She doesn't like something about the human face.
My youngest daughter hated dolls, and when she was 5 years old. Back then, there was this doll that would actually eat the children's hair, and it was taken off the market. And she had that horrible experience. You bought this doll, and it started to bite her hair and eat her hair. So she does not like dolls.
Yeah, there's something about that. Yeah, like you said, about that human face. So you think that it invites a demonic presence?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah. And does it depend on the doll? Are there certain dolls that are more inclined to?
You know, you never know. I mean, sometimes you'll get a doll. And it's very simple. And all of a sudden people say, oh, the energy there is really, really, really bad. We do not like that energy. And they would call me up and, Ed, please get this doll out of my house.
Is that mostly your doll collection? So you don't really need to go out and collect dolls. They come to you.
Yes. People bring, like I said, I just got one last week.
Yeah. Because I guess you couldn't walk into a shop and say, hey, any of your dolls here haunted?
Right. Even though I have felt that energy with the dolls, but I still always believe that no matter how much negative energy is in any of the paranormal objects, I still feel that the belief in Christ and God supersedes that. And as I used to teach the martial arts, I used to give an example to a lot of my students. In fact, we have proof that women that are 99 pounds have picked up cause to save a child's life. And that's the power of good. However, there's no documentation of a 99-pound woman picking up a car and hurting a child. So that proves to me that good is more powerful than evil.
I like that. That's nice.
Thank you.
Luke, before we get to the Archangel Michael, you want to step in on any of these haunted objects?
I do. I wanted to ask so you'd mentioned there's an energy that kind of exudes from these dolls. What sensation does it elicit? What feelings? Explain that energy a bit.
Okay, well, today we had an example. Three people looked in the doll rooms. One felt nauseous, one person felt dizzy, and one person couldn't breathe. So I didn't like that. I felt bad for them, so I said a prayer for them, and they left feeling much better.
Why do some people experience this more than others?
I think it's their sensitivity. I think certain people are more open to the supernatural concept, more open to the universe, and they're just more highly sensitive people. Sometimes they call them indigo children. It's just people that are highly sensitive, and they can feel things that average people can't.
And what is your approach? How do you protect yourself in the presence of these things?
I protect myself through prayer. I protect myself through not giving any attention to it. Now, I have to admit, living upstairs above the museum, prior to going to the Exorcist conference in May, there are times where I did get spooked out. There are times, and I'm not the type when I hear a noise to say, oh, it's a scary thing. You know, it's usually the refrigerator or my cat. But there are times that in the past I would be frightened. However, at this point, I just don't, because I won't give it any strength. I won't give it any power. And I know that good will conquer evil. Though you have to be proactive, and I think there's a constant battle. And I prefer to stay strong in my own mindset, so I can do the best possible job I can for other people.
Yeah, I've had people ask me, like, you know, oh, Rob, I think my house is haunted, you know, because of what I do. They'll come and say, oh, what do I do about this? And I said, well, you know, you really need to think positively and have trust and trust in the good, like you're saying, and sort of project that intentionally out into the space. Does that jive for you?
Absolutely. That's exactly how I feel. And just do good things. And it's like my fiance believes that, and she's a very, very spiritual person, and she's an amazing human being. She has helped me a lot in understanding this battle between good and evil. She has helped me understanding that if you don't give something power, it is not going to be powerful. And if you do believe in good, and the more negative things that happen in the world, we believe that the devil get stronger. He almost lives off that energy. So if you do positive things, you also give edification and strength to the good force. So, and sometimes it's simple. Sometimes it's just taking a moment to open the door for someone. Sometimes it's a moment of just being more patient. Sometimes it's helping a stranger when they need help. Those small aspects really make a big difference in the world. And that's what I want to convey and hope to convey in the museum, that that's what it's about.
And when you talk about not giving it power, do you mean overcoming that fear that you might have at the initial encounter?
Absolutely. I've always said on the Exorcist conference, I was with 250 exorcists. It was not mass hysteria. It was real honest conversation. And these guys are much stronger than Mike Tyson. I like to see Mike Tyson last 2 minutes, and no disrespect to Mike Tyson, because I don't want him coming after me. Even though I wouldn't mind the money that would draw in a fight, that would probably be something. All right, Mike Tyson, I challenge you to a fight right now. But he couldn't handle it. He couldn't last 2 seconds. And he would say he couldn't, you know? And these people, they're amazingly powerful, and their dedication to good is beautiful.
So there's a spiritual intensity to them.
Absolutely, absolutely. A strong spiritual intensity. And this is what we need in this world in order to bring more peace and love into this world, because there is a lot of bad. So why don't the people that are good step up to the plate and do good things?
I mean, and if we're thinking about this, like, you know, you're training people, how do you train for this kind of spiritual intensity?
It takes years. I think it takes a strong belief, and it's a constant battle. It's like doing push-ups. One day you do 10, then you do 12, then you do 15. I mean, they're constantly trying to build themselves up. And it's fearful at times, because I saw videos that were frightening, that were amazing, and the people were able to handle it. You know, most of the time they say that an exorcist should not go alone. He should definitely go with someone. I keep telling Megan when I do an exorcism, she's coming with me. And she's looking at me now, scared out of her mind.
So you've performed exorcisms?
Actually, I have not performed exorcisms. I've performed prayers of liberation. So I'm not really qualified, especially in Roman Catholic, to perform an exorcism, because you can't do it unless you are a priest. I'm not a priest. And unless you have permission from a bishop. I'm not that. I did get permission from my local priests and bishops to go on the conference, but I can do prayers of liberation. Now, on the Catholic concept, any person that's baptized can do what's called a simple exorcism. Let's say, for example, a person was dying and there's not a priest around. A baptized person can perform the last rites. A baptized person can perform prayers at any time. So under the concept there, a baptized person can perform a simple exorcism as well.
Now, what would a simple exorcism include versus more of a conventional exorcism?
Okay, so a simple exorcism is where you would pray to Jesus, Mother Mary, or God to eliminate the demon from the person. And it's basically prayers, but there's no commanding. You don't go directly and say, like you see in the movies, I'm like, leave this body immediately. Devil, you go. No, that's out of your pay grade. That's going to be a problem. Trust me, I tried that once, and that was the biggest problem of my life. No, thank you. Not doing it.
So prayers of liberation, you get up to a bit more than the simple exorcism? Or
no, the simple exorcism and prayers of liberation are basically the same. But if you go into a more complex exorcism, you would have to be qualified, and you would have to have permission from a bishop. And you would really have to be a person that studied it. Any lay person, we are all lay people, we can do simple exorcisms. Now, even though now I'm an ordained minister, I still would only do a simple exorcism. I don't feel qualified to do an exorcism.
From a Catholic standpoint, is it considered a sacrament?
Yeah, definitely. It is a sacrament.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, Luke, before we, can I do Michael now or no?
Sure.
Okay. Let's talk about Michael. So you've talked about Jesus and Mary being very important to your faith. Why Michael? Why a Michael room?
Well, personally, I like the Archangel Michael. I think a lot of art is just beautiful. I actually have him in the background here, but we're not really seeing it. He is the strongest of the archangels. I mean, Michael believes to be like God, you know. It was a very strong angel, and he had a lot of powers.
So why do you want people to experience Michael in particular, I guess, at the end of their encounter with the other artifacts?
Well, I do have a 19th century statue of Mother Mary. I do have probably about a dozen crucifixes in that room as well. But I love the imagery of Michael slaying the devil. And I was going to put a sign in the room to say, excuse me, though, if the devil was so strong, then why did he get his ass kicked by the Archangel Michael?
so it's like if there's a narrative to your museum, then people are encountering the dark side, and then at the end of the story, Michael is triumphing.
Exactly. And that makes me very happy. And I love that room.
That's interesting. So tell us more about the artifacts in that room. So you have a Mary and some crucifixes?
Yeah, we have about five foot statues in marble and iron from the 19th and 18th century of the Archangel Michael. We have about 15 wood carving with polychrome finishes and silver with the Archangel Michael, and various artwork and paintings. It's really a beautiful room. All kidding aside, it's really amazing. I'm very proud of it. And I can honestly say I have not seen, and I've traveled to museums. That's my hobby. And I used to go to all the museums in the world. Haven't seen many rooms and museums that are interesting. I have seen beautiful art in all the churches, of course, but I'm very, very happy with this room.
Where do the Michaels come from? Are these churches that are done with them? I mean, it's hard for the decommissioned churches.
No, there's not a lot of decommissioned. The only thing you get out of a church is when a church is sold, you might get the stained glass and buy it. I've bought a couple of churches in my life that were decommissioned, as you're saying, and it was for the stained glass. But usually the Archangel Michaels are just from auction houses or private collectors.
So people have them in their homes or in their private chapels or something.
Exactly. And people pass away. And, you know, sometimes some of the families, you know, like they sell antiques, they would be selling the collection. And I try to keep every Archangel Michael.
That's interesting. Luke?
So with these Michaels, or this is open to any kind of pieces within your collection, do you have anything that's something that you would consider maybe your strongest attachment to, or that someone else may consider rare or unique, or just what, in your opinion, is the most interesting artifact that you have collected?
Well, right. It would go into a situation. People ask me that all the time, is what's your most interesting artifact? What is your favorite piece? You know, I have one bronze plaque that I love. And what it is depicting is the devil and a man playing chess for the man's soul. I happen to like it because I'm a chess player, so I really enjoy the imagery there. And that's one of my favorite pieces. I do have pieces that are more interesting to other people. And everyone comes into a museum and they fall in love with a different item. They go, oh my gosh, this is amazing. Oh, this is unbelievable. A lot of times with the good stuff, with the items that are representing God and the positive side, it's amazing that so many people are drawn to that. And that's what I'm very proud of the museum, because people are looking at the interest of what I would call the darker pieces, the Ouija boards, some of the vampire killing sets, even though they were not really darker, they were supposed to help people. But people still go back to the Archangel Michael room all the time, and they love the beauty there. And that's primarily, I have one statue I recently purchased that has silver, and it's in a polychrome, and it's one of my favorite Archangel Michaels I've ever owned. Actually, it's right behind me, but you can't see it right now.
So people are drawn, yeah, what are people drawn to? What do people tend to congregate around? What's your Mona Lisas in your museum?
You know, it's always different. I mean, people are fascinated by the vampire killing sets. Remember, we have a lot of items. People are interested in the dolls. We do have an area with African art that people look at, and they have a lot of fascination with that. We have a gigantic carriage that's beautiful that's in the museum. That's a carriage that would be a traveling carriage, like almost like a hearse. And it's all in polychrome wood and carved wood. And this was used to go to villages where groups of people will kill vampires. This is one of the major pieces in the museum. Very rare item. And it's huge. I mean, it was drawn by a horse. Getting it in the museum was a lot of work. So that's one of the more interesting pieces as well.
It also helps give us a better idea of scale of everything.
Yes.
Yeah, that's true. But Luke, there's people that would gather Ed and go town to town in a hearse to
Absolutely.
Kill vampires.
And we have the original vampire killing devices in it. And they would go town to town. It has about six Bibles in it, probably about 30 stakes, axes in it, and they would go town to town for hire in order to rid people of vampires.
That is remarkable. Do you know what that would run me? How much is that going to cost to go town?
I don't know. I still haven't figured out the cost of that. I don't even know what I would charge if someone asked me.
But to bring all your friends, I mean, that can't be cheap.
That would be, yeah, that would be interesting. And it just reminds me of a funny story. I had a professor once, I won't mention names, from a very important college, Princeton University. And he came to me to buy a vampire killing set because he believed his wife was a vampire and he wanted to rid her of her life. Obviously, I didn't sell it to him. And I did see, you know, suggest that he would see a therapist.
At the very least, yeah.
Or maybe a marriage counselor.
Right, a marriage counselor or a therapist at that point. But he was serious. He really believed his wife was a vampire. Now, if I don't believe that's true, but it could be possible that his wife was having some demonic, you know, oppression and he was getting it confused. But killing her is not the right way to go about it.
No, that's the most extreme non-positive anything that you could possibly do. No way.
No.
Luke, anything on our list that we missed?
Something that I'm curious about, and this might just be from my background, but you have it laid out so you have this pleasant resolution at the end of the museum through the exhibit with the Archangel Michael. But looking at it from, you know, an educational perspective, what is it you're trying to teach people the most? What is the main lesson that you're trying to convey to all of your guests? What is it that you want people to leave holding on to or leave remembering the most?
Well, there are a few lessons. Like I said, the museum is based on the battle between good and evil, how art has been influenced by the battle between good and evil. But the lesson I'm trying to convey in a simple form is really just be good. You know, just do good for mankind, just help people. I think that it's our responsibility to protect children. I think it's our responsibility to do the best possible job to rid evil off the planet. And in my own little way and through, you know, God's way of saying, okay, this is what I need to do, that is what I'm trying to convey. I do love art. I'm in the antique business. I am fascinated by beautiful items and I'm fascinated by historical items. But the end result is I want to convey and create a place where children can play in the park, where people can learn things, where people can smile and be happy.
Well, following up from that, where do you want to go from here? Like, how do you plan, if you do plan, I should say, on expanding or building out more? Or what's your next goal?
You know, I'm not really sure. This is a lot of work.
Oh, I'm sure.
I think that perhaps, you know, you can't really supply 20 museums either. You know, I've had my museums in the Everhart Museum on display in various museums. I think going from here is just really working on this property for the next couple of years. I do plan to show some films here. We have, you know, the area where we can do that. Maybe have some interesting parties here and probably just end up working on this property. Perhaps in the future, there might be a secondary museum, mm-hmm. but I'm not really sure now where that's going to go.
Do you have any future exhibits in mind?
That we will have here?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, we're going to have definitely future exhibits. And we will have things on our websites when we acquire new items. We'll have a rotating inventory at times when something special comes in. We have a couple of secret special things coming in the spring, and we'll advertise that. Oh, yeah, we'll definitely have different items all the time and special events. I do want to show this incredible documentary that I saw when I was in Rome. It shows really the beauty of the exorcism in a different form, not in a scary form, but in a form of liberation. So I would like to have the opportunity to actually show that here as well.
I mean, that sounds like a beautiful kind of way to keep it going.
Thank you. Yeah, this is really what we're trying to do. I mean, it's my passion at this point.
I love it. We share that, Ed.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Luke, you feeling good?
I am. This was a fantastic conversation.
Yeah,
I enjoyed it, gentlemen. It was very nice.
It's been a pleasure. We want to thank well, Luke, you do the conclusion.
Ed, we want to thank you. We want to thank the Vamper Museum as well. We encourage anyone any of our listeners, and especially if you're out here on the East Coast, get down to Doylestown and just go check it out. It sounds like spring is going to be a really fantastic time to get down there. And hopefully, you know, Ed's got some things up his sleeve.
Give us those contact details, Ed. If people want to come to the Vampire Museum, what should they do?
I'm basically, you would just go on our website, vampamuseum.com.
V-A-M-P-A.
V-A-M-P-A, museum.com.
Cool.
And you guys have to come and visit the museum.
Yes.
All right. Yeah, just give me a call. Give me a call. I'd love to meet you in person, and I hope to share with you a lot of the ideas and the growth of the museum in the future.
Absolutely. Yeah, this has been fantastic.
And thank you, because I really felt your spiritual energy. I was a little concerned, to be honest with you, where this would go. And I think you guys are on the right track, and I appreciate that, and God bless.
That's okay.
Thank you so much.
Anytime Rob is involved.
We are very white light here at Occult Confessions.
I like that, and I really like that. I really like that. I didn't want to have to hunt you guys down with my vampire killing sets.
No.
With your martial arts background, we'd both be in trouble.
No, we would just have to hide.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. I really appreciate the opportunity to share
and
with
thank
you.
Thank you for spending Saturday night with us, Ed. Take care.
Be well. God bless.